decades that the one area in which the states were most clearly entitled to independence was in the application of their criminal law. Nothing could seem more obvious to us today than that to convict a man in an unfair criminal trial is to deprive him of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Yet it was not until 1923 that the court specifically said unfair methods in a criminal trial were forbidden by the 14th Amendment. That was an extreme case. 5 Arkansas Negroes condemned to death after a mob-dominated trial and on testimony said to have been extorted by brutality. Justice Holmes suggested that the entire proceeding was a mask, with counsel, judge, and jury swept to the fatal end by an irresistible wave of public passion. The decision was only to let the prisoners come into federal court and try to prove their charges of unconstitutional treatment, not to set aside their convictions. Even at that, Justice James C. McReynolds dissented, saying, "The fact that petitioners are poor and ignorant and black naturally arouses sympathy, but that does not release us from enforcing principles which are essential to the orderly operation of our federal system." The 5 prisoners eventually had their sentences commuted by state authorities without final legal action. Over the years, the Supreme Court steadfastly resisted all efforts to apply to the states the specific criminal law guarantees of the Bill of Rights, such as the 6th Amendment's provision for trial by jury and assistance of counsel, and the 5th Amendment's ban on double jeopardy and self-incrimination. In 1949, the 4th Amendment's prohibition on illegal searches and seizures was dealt with in a notable opinion by Justice Frankfurter. He deeply opposed illegal police intrusion on the home, the knock at the door, he called it, but he could not put aside his firm belief in state independence. In this dilemma, he took a curious compromise position. He held that the core of the 4th Amendment was absorbed into the Due Process Clause of the 14th, but he refused to apply to the states the essential enforcement device that had bound the federal courts since 1914, the rule that illegally seized material must be excluded from evidence at a man's trial. History, then, showed a special reluctance on the part of the Supreme Court to impose on the states uniform national standards of fair criminal procedure. But there were signs of change in that history. Beginning in 1936, the court had struck down state criminal convictions based on confessions coerced from the defendant. At first, the third degree, physical brutality, was condemned. Over the years, the court gradually raised its standards of decency, condemning psychological as well as physical coercion of prisoners. By the 1950s, it was clear that the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment was a pervasive guarantee against convictions based on extorted confessions, whether or not there was external evidence to support the truthfulness of the confession. The aim was not just to rule out suspect confessions, but to discourage illegal police practices. That attitude on the part of the court signaled more vigilance toward state criminal procedure in general. Another long step was taken in 1956, in the case of Griffin v. Illinois. Under the law of Illinois, a person desiring to appeal his criminal conviction had to supply to the appellate court a transcript of his trial. A man too poor to buy one could not appeal. The Supreme Court held, 5-4, that such a distinction between rich and poor denied the equal protection of the laws guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. A state must provide a free transcript to poor prisoners, or some less elaborate trial record that would furnish a basis for appeal. The Griffin case marked a significant increase in the court's willingness to impose minimum standards of fairness on state criminal process. It was met by bitter criticism from the Conference of Chief Justices, among other state sources, but the trend continued. In 1961, just a year before it granted Clarence Earl Gideon's petition for review, the court took the step that Justice Frankfurter and a majority had been unwilling to take on illegal searches in 1949. In the case of Mapp v. Ohio, it overruled the earlier decision and held that the 4th Amendment was now fully applicable to the states. No illegally seized evidence could be admitted at state criminal trials. Justice Frankfurter, joined by Justices Harlan and Whitaker, dissented. Map v. Ohio certainly had import for the Gideon case. A majority had been willing to overrule a recent decision, and to do so in the face of strongly pressed claims of federalism. The court had been warned that imposing a uniform national prohibition on illegal evidence would cripple state law enforcement and empty the jails, just as it could expect to be told in the Gideon case about the baleful effects of a uniform counsel requirement. The ruling in Mapp, together with the long series of coerced confession cases and the protection given the poor prisoner in Griffin v. Illinois, suggested a broad movement of the Supreme Court away from regard for state independence as a primary value in the constitutional law of criminal procedure. Younger justices, brought up in a United States that had become a nation, were concerned less about federalism and more about national ideals of fairness. Justice Brennan indicated the difference in attitude in a speech a few months before Mapp v. Ohio was decided. "Federalism should not be raised to the plane of an absolute," he said, "nor the Bill of Rights be reduced to a precatory trust. Far too many cases come from the states to the Supreme Court presenting dismal pictures of official lawlessness, of illegal searches and seizures, illegal detentions attended by prolonged interrogation and coerced admissions of guilt, of the denial of counsel." Chapter 7. Clarence Earl Gideon probably knew little of the legal history that underlay his case, and nothing of the Supreme Court's great struggles over federalism, stare decisis, and judicial review. It is doubtful that he could even have defined those phrases. In that he would not have differed from many more elevated Americans. But he did have an intuitive sense that his case was larger than himself, that he was part of a movement in history and would affect that movement. Or so it seemed to a stranger, interested in the case, who visited the prison at Rayford, Florida, to talk with him. "In Betts versus Brady, they were trying to allow him their state's rights," Gideon said. "They gave the state courts discretion, but they don't use any discretion. They just say no. They talk about states' rights. I think there's only one state, the United States." Judging from the externals, it would be hard to imagine a figure less likely to be the subject of a great case in the Supreme Court of the United States. Gideon seems a man whose own private hopes and fears have long since been deadened by adversity, a used-up man looking 15 years older than his actual age of 52. He was born on August 30, 1910. His figure is gaunt, a stooped 6 feet, 140 pounds. Behind light-framed glasses are worried eyes, set far back, with deep creases in the skin around them. His features are sharp, his ears prominent, his gray-white hair wavy. His lower lip trembles, and he speaks in a slow, sad, defeated voice. It would be difficult, too, to create a setting as dejected as the locale of Gideon's alleged crime. Panama City, 1960 population 33,275, is a town in the still largely undeveloped northwest panhandle of Florida. Just outside the city limits, 20 minutes from the motels and restaurants and post office that make downtown, is a gigantic International Paper Company plant, its tall chimneys spewing out sulfurous smoke. Huddled near the plant fence, within sight and smell of the chemical fumes, is the community of Bay Harbor. Community is too grandiose a word for it. Bay Harbor is a bitter, decayed parody of a movie set for a frontier town. It is just a few dilapidated buildings separated by dirt roads and alleys and weed-filled empty lots, a bar, a two-story hotel, a grocery, and the Bay Harbor pool room. One who happened onto that dark street would be eager to drive back through the dank countryside to the highway and its neon. Gideon had no illusions about Bay Harbor. He called it Tobacco Road. Gideon's temporary home, the state prison at Rayford, was cheerful by comparison. At the entrance there was no doubt that it was a prison. There were steel gates and a sign saying, that day, 1,986 white males, 1,303 colored males. quarters are completely segregated. But inside, the scene was unexpectedly unforbidding, with small buildings separated by green lawns and beautifully kept shrubs and flowers. Trustees, wearing uniforms of white fatigues, something like a hospital orderly's outfit, wandered around freely. During the lunch hour, some sat around outdoors smoking pipes and reading. Gideon was a trustee. He met his visitor in the prison courtroom, a bare room with a long table used occasionally by inmates writing to courts. Gideon complained about the facilities. "Here's the place you have to write your petition," he said. "And you don't have no help. That's what hurts you. The Supreme Court sent me a book of rules, but I still can't understand that. The rules take a pretty educated man to understand them." He filled a cigarette paper and rolled it in his long, rather artistic fingers, stained with nicotine. "There's no real lawyers in here now. I guess I know more than most, and I help out. I have one boy in here that can't read or write. I wrote a letter to the Supreme Court of Florida for him, asking them to appoint an attorney to write him a petition for habeas corpus. They accepted that letter as a petition and denied it without a hearing. So I wrote the whole thing over and sent it to the Supreme Court of the U.S. This prisoner was named Alan Baxley, Jr. The court was holding the petition until Gideon's case was decided. It was clear, in fact, that Gideon enjoyed his role as prison legal expert, and he had some sense of what he was about. He correctly complained, for example, about his trial judge's statement that Florida law did not permit appointment of counsel in a non-capital case. Florida law merely did not require such appointment. "That wasn't the law," Gideon said. "He had all the power in the world to appoint a lawyer if he wanted to." Gideon appreciated the quality of the letters he had had from Abe Fortas. "I notice he never makes a statement that isn't well thought out. He never writes you anything that isn't exactly that way." The prison records concurred with the past that Gideon had described in his long letter to Fortas. The felonies he had listed were all there. 1928, burglary in Missouri, 10-year sentence, paroled after 3. 1934, a federal charge, possession of government property, 3 years. 1940, another Missouri burglary, 10 years, escaped in 1944, recaptured a year later, released in 1950. 1951, burglary in Texas, 2 years, released September 25, 1952. After that, there was nothing serious until the episode of the Bay Harbor pool room in June 1961. The record did show some arrests for investigation in Panama City and a 20-day sentence for drunkenness there. A prison report described Gideon as the typical recidivist type, an incurable repeater. Someone had noted in his file, "At present time, does not have anyone for the mailing or visiting list." The prison officials did not mind Gideon's legal activities. Indeed, they seemed to regard them as therapy. One said, "Usually when they're trying to get out legally, you know they walk on their toes around here." They knew all about his case in the Supreme Court, but even the possible effect of a victory for Gideon on other prisoners who had been tried without counsel did not seem to bother them, as it did some prosecutors. An assistant warden said, "Our feeling is, boys, if you can get out of here legal, we're with you." Gideon was asked why he had insisted so strenuously on a lawyer, all the way from the Circuit Court of Bay County to the Supreme Court of the United States. "I knew that was my only chance," he said. "I don't know if you've ever been in one of these courtrooms, but the prejudice is obvious. In this state, except for Dade County, Miami, in Dade County they go by the books, they just run over people who have nothing. I've never taken the witness stand in this case. Nobody knows what I'd say. Without a lawyer, with the criminal record I had, what I'd have said, they'd never have paid any attention to." The idea of prejudice on the part of Florida officials against the poor and unfortunate was a fixation with Gideon. He spoke again and again about the welfare authorities and what he called their attempt to take his children from him. He spoke bitterly of the Florida Supreme Court and its refusal to do anything about counsel for the poor. "These people are not vicious," he said, and he seemed to be talking about the citizens as well as the officials of Florida. They just have beliefs they've lived by all their lives. They think it's perfectly all right to take a man into a courtroom and deny him all his rights. I was reading here a while back, I believe it was Milton's Essay on Liberty. He writes about Socrates and Christ, which was two judicial cases tried by the people. He showed that these people were not any different from what they are now, not mean people or anything. They're just used to things. As prisoners often do, Gideon complained of so many raw deals that it was hard to separate fact from feelings of persecution. He spoke of harsh sentences some of his fellow inmates had been given, and of inequities in Florida law. At times, his wanderings into legalism grew incoherent, and he had to be steered back to the point. But he never made any effort to justify his life. He only wanted his rights. You can't justify a crime, whether it's murder or petty larceny, but they can go by the book in trying you and sentencing you. He would not say so, but there was every sign that Gideon expected the Supreme Court to rule in his favor. He said all the inmates were thinking about the case, even though the intelligence of the people in here is not the greatest in the world. A lot of the men, he said, think they're just going to have to call the buses in here and turn them loose. Afterward, he hoped the American Civil Liberties Union would give him an attorney to help him fight the charge of breaking and entering the Bay Harbor pool room at a new trial. He had also thought about what he might do if he were finally free. The only reason I never left Panama City was that I couldn't get enough money to leave. That's hard to move, a family. If I get out of here, I'm a good automobile electric mechanic. I wouldn't begin to say I was a journeyman electrician or anything like that, but I'd like to get a maintenance job somewhere, or have a little shop of my own and work on one car at a time, generators and batteries and things like that. Gideon had thought, too, about the Supreme Court and its part in assuring counsel to every criminal defendant. Without the Supreme Court, it might have happened sometime, he said, but it wouldn't have happened in this state soon. Had he read any of the recent Supreme Court decisions on the right to counsel? No, only what you read in the paper. You know, you read that some boy was given the right to a lawyer. If he had read the decisions and understood them, Gideon could not have been any less confident in victory for himself and his principal. For the court, in its own sophisticated way, had been groping toward Clarence Earl Gideon's simple feeling about the importance of a lawyer to a poor man charged with crime. Chapter 8. The most innocent man, pressed by the awful solemnities of public accusation and trial, may be incapable of supporting his own cause. He may be utterly unfit to cross-examine the witnesses against him, to point out the contradictions or defects of their testimony, and to counteract it by properly introducing it and applying his own. So wrote William Rawl, a Philadelphia lawyer, in 1825. Probably no one can adequately appreciate the need for a lawyer in a criminal case until he is himself a defendant. The sense of loneliness, the confusion of guilt and outrage, the feeling that one is caught up in machinery he does not understand. All these emotions well up in a person who finds himself arrested for even a moderately serious traffic offense. And how much greater are the chances today than in 1825 that the average citizen will at some point be caught up in the criminal law? The Jeffersonian dream of a happy rural society of sturdy, independent yeomen has died with industrialization, the growth of cities, and the population explosion. The social pressures of urban industrial life are all too familiar, as are the ugly human manifestations they produce. Society has had to respond with a vast proliferation of criminal statutes, covering life with a scope and detail that would have amazed William Rawl. Judge Bernard Botin and Murray A. Gordon, in a recent book, note that more than 1 million Americans are convicted of crime every year, and they say that many times that number are spared only by inadequate facilities for law enforcement or the benign discretion of police or prosecutors. With only a little exaggeration, they argue that few citizens are truly exempt from the coverage of a modern penal code, touching on such matters as gambling, intoxication, sex offenses, tax evasion, traffic violations, and business malpractices, not to mention the more traditional crimes of violence. There is hardly any freedom from technical guilt, they conclude, only from prosecution. If the multiplication of offenses has made the lawyer's role more essential, so have the increasing subtlety and complexity of the criminal trial itself. Even the availability of new constitutional protections for the defendant has increased, not lessened, the need for a lawyer. The defendant cannot be expected to effectively assert his right to an impartial jury, his right to keep out illegal evidence, his right to challenge the voluntary nature of a confession. The question of the legality of evidence alone fills volumes of law books. And so today, few would disagree with the comment of one of the most highly regarded state judges, Walter V. Schaefer of the Supreme Court of Illinois. Of all the rights that an accused person has, the right to be represented by counsel is by far the most pervasive, for it affects his ability to assert any other rights he may have. The right to counsel does not, however, go so far back into history as might be assumed. The common law of England did not even allow a man accused of treason or felony to be represented by counsel, except that a lawyer could argue legal points suggested by the accused. Full representation was allowed in misdemeanor cases. Apparently, the theory was that the more grave the charge, the less chance the accused should have to escape conviction. It must be remembered that up through the 17th century, felony defendants were treated in most respects with what now seems to be unremitting harshness. They were not allowed to testify, to call sworn witnesses on their behalf, or even to see the charges before trial. In 1695, Parliament mitigated the judge-made rules of the common law to the extent of allowing treason defendants to be represented by counsel. It was not until 1836, nearly a half century after the Sixth Amendment was added to the American Constitution, that another statute extended to all felony defendants in England the privilege of being represented by counsel. The Sixth Amendment provided, among other things, that in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. As a matter of history, it is clear that the purpose of the provision was to prevent the adoption in the federal courts of the old common law rule barring defense counsel in felony cases. Most of the 13 colonies had rejected that rule and permitted the accused to retain counsel. The Sixth Amendment was designed to assure that right to all who might be charged with crime by the new federal government. Historically speaking, the amendment was almost certainly not envisaged by its framers as reaching the problem of the man too poor to hire a lawyer for his defense. But over the years, that became the real problem of counsel in American criminal justice. No precise national figures are available, but various states have estimated that between 30% and 60% of all those they convict these days cannot afford to retain a lawyer. Certainly, the numbers are large, and every justice who was to participate in the Gideon case knew from his experience on the Supreme Court, however brief, that many of the claimed flaws in the criminal convictions brought to that court resulted from the inability of the prisoner to pay for counsel at his trial. The treatment of the right to counsel issue in the Supreme Court is a fascinating example of how constitutional doctrine develops there, slowly, deliberately, case by case. Understanding does require discussion of a fair number of cases, for few issues have had a more thorough exploration in the court. The story begins in 1932, in the Scottsboro case, Powell v. Alabama, one of the few incontestably great cases in the Supreme Court's history. The case started in a freight train moving slowly across the countryside of northern Alabama. Professor Francis A. Allen of the University of Chicago says, in a classic outline of the story, "It was a time of economic distress and social unrest. As if in response to some common impulse, thousands of young people, no one knows how many, left their homes and communities to drift across the land by train and on foot, presumably in search of work, but in reality often without any defined or definable objective. In a gondola car of the train rode two groups of youths, one composed of Negroes, the other whites. Among the latter were two white girls. What occurred has ever since been the subject of sharp controversy. It is at least established that a dispute broke out between the Negroes and the whites. There was a fight, and all but one of the white boys were thrown off the slow-moving train. Word was sent ahead, and when the freight approached the village of Scottsboro, the Negroes were met by the sheriff and a posse. The charge was rape of the white girls. Fearing the violence of the community, the sheriff moved the defendants to the neighboring town of Gadsden. The militia was called to Scottsboro to maintain order. A few days later, the defendants were tried in three separate proceedings. Each of the three trials was completed in the space of a single day. All the defendants were convicted of rape, and the juries imposed the sentence of death on each. Those were the convictions and sentences before the Supreme Court in Powell v. Alabama. The opinion of the court was written by Justice George Sutherland, one of the four conservatives so hateful to New Deal liberals. The question he considered was whether the seven Scottsboro boys, as they were called, had had the effective assistance of counsel. They were tried 6 days after their indictment. At the trial, there was a long, confusing colloquy between the judge and some of the lawyers of Scottsboro, in which the judge said he had appointed all the members of the bar for the purposes of arraigning the defendants and expected them to carry on at the trial if no one else turned up to represent the accused. With this dubious understanding, Justice Sutherland said, the trials immediately proceeded. The defendants, young, ignorant, illiterate, surrounded by hostile sentiment, hailed back and forth under guard of soldiers, charged with an atrocious crime, regarded with especial horror in the community where they were to be tried, were thus put in peril. Justice Sutherland put aside the Sixth Amendment as a guide to decision. The precedents had rejected any claim that it applied to the states or had been incorporated in the 14th Amendment automatically. But the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, he said, at least required a hearing, and for a meaningful hearing, counsel was fundamental. The right to be heard would be, in many cases, of little avail if it did not comprehend the right to be heard by counsel. Even the intelligent and educated layman has small and sometimes no skill in the science of law. If charged with crime, he is incapable, generally, of determining for himself whether the indictment is good or bad. He is unfamiliar with the rules of evidence. Left without the aid of counsel, he may be put on trial without a proper charge and convicted upon incompetent evidence or evidence irrelevant to the issue or otherwise inadmissible. He lacks both the skill and knowledge adequately to prepare his defense, even though he have a perfect one. He requires the guiding hand of counsel at every step in the proceedings against him. Without it, though he be not guilty, he faces the danger of conviction because he does not know how to establish his innocence. If that be true of men of intelligence, how much more true is it of the ignorant and illiterate, or those of feeble intellect? On those premises, the opinion concluded that it would be a denial of due process of law, and a violation, therefore, of the 14th Amendment, for a court arbitrarily to deny any party to a case, civil or criminal, the right to be heard by counsel of his choice. And the facts of this case, Justice Sutherland said, amounted to a denial of reasonable time and opportunity to secure counsel. But he did not stop there. Passing that, Justice Sutherland wrote, and assuming their inability, even if opportunity had been given, to employ counsel, we are of opinion that, under the circumstances just stated, the necessity of counsel was so vital and imperative that the failure of the trial court to make an effective appointment of counsel was likewise a denial of due process within the meaning of the 14th Amendment. For the first time, the Supreme Court had held that the Constitution could entitle the poor and friendless accused to the lawyer he could not retain himself. But Justice Sutherland carefully limited the holding of the case to its particular facts. the circumstances just stated, as he had said. Whether this would be so in other criminal prosecutions or under other circumstances, we need not determine. All that is necessary now to decide, as we do decide, is that in a capital case, where the defendant is unable to employ counsel and is incapable adequately of making his own defense because of ignorance, feeble-mindedness, illiteracy, or the like, it is the duty of the court, whether requested or not, to assign counsel for him as a necessary requisite of due process of law. Powell v. Alabama was an historic advance for liberty. It was the first occasion on which the Supreme Court had actually reversed a state criminal conviction because of unfair procedures at trial. But by any fair reading, Justice Sutherland's opinion meant less than the universal requirement of counsel in every criminal trial that Gideon was asking the Supreme Court to prescribe. Justice Sutherland had taken care to restrict the case to its compelling circumstances, a capital crime, an agitated community, obviously helpless defendants. It was 6 years before the court considered the issue of counsel in a less agitated setting. The next landmark in the history of the right to counsel was Johnson v. Zerbst. It was a federal case, a conviction for passing counterfeit money. Justice Black, in his first term on the court, wrote the majority opinion. He said nothing of any special difficulties under which the defendant labored, and for all that could be told, there were none. The opinion quoted some of what Justice Sutherland had said in Powell v. Alabama about the importance of a lawyer, adding only the comment that the average defendant does not have the professional legal skill to protect himself when brought before a tribunal with power to take his life and liberty, wherein the prosecution is represented by experienced and learned counsel. That which is simple, orderly, and necessary to the lawyer, to the untrained layman, may appear intricate, complex, and mysterious. The opinion did not discuss the history of the Sixth Amendment, with its object of overcoming the English rule against counsel for felony defendants. Justice Black said simply that the language of the amendment now required the appointment of counsel for all who could not afford it in federal criminal cases. The amendment withholds from federal courts in all criminal proceedings, he said, the power and authority to deprive an accused of his life or liberty unless he has or waives the assistance of counsel. He had a bare majority for that proposition. Chief Justice Hughes and Justices Brandeis, Harlan F. Stone, and Owen J. Roberts, in addition to himself. There matters stood for 4 years. In the state courts, the 14th Amendment required appointment of counsel in some cases, but just which ones was not certain. In federal courts, the 6th Amendment required counsel in all criminal cases. Many informed observers thought it was inevitable that the requirement would be extended to the states. But then, in 1942, came Betts v. Brady. Smith Betts was a farmhand in rural Carroll County, Maryland. He was charged with robbery, and he asked the court to appoint a lawyer for him because he was too poor to hire one. The judge refused, explaining, just as a Florida judge was to explain to Clarence Earl Gideon 20 years later, that the practice in Carroll County was to appoint lawyers for the indigent only in prosecutions for murder and rape. Like Gideon, Betts acted as his own lawyer, cross-examining the prosecution witnesses and calling his own. The main issues were identification of Betts as the robber and the validity of an alibi he put forward. The judge who tried the case believed the prosecution, found Betts guilty, and imposed an 8-year sentence. Eventually, Betts filed a petition for habeas corpus with Chief Judge Carroll T. Bond of Maryland's Court of Appeals, claiming that the refusal to give him a lawyer violated his constitutional rights. Again, the same procedure that Gideon was to follow in 20 years. Judge Bond reviewed the record of the trial and rejected Betts's claim in a detailed opinion. The trial, he said, has been a routine, simple affair, so that in this case, it must be said, there was little for counsel to do on either side. Betts had been able to take care of his own interests. In the Supreme Court, a 6-3 majority agreed with Judge Bond. Justice Roberts wrote the opinion for the majority, rejecting as unworthy of extended discussion any contention that the Sixth Amendment was applicable as such to the states. The question was whether the constraint laid by the amendment upon the national courts expresses a rule so fundamental and essential to a fair trial, and so to due process of law, that it is made obligatory upon the states by the 14th Amendment. To find the answer, the court must look to the constitutions, statutes, and judicial decisions of the states originally and at present. The most authoritative sources for ascertaining the considered judgment of the citizens of the states upon the question. Justice Roberts first reviewed the council provisions of the 13 original states at the time of the writing of the Constitution, and concluded that they were designed not to assure lawyers for the poor, but to reject the English common law rule and let those who could afford it retain counsel. In Johnson v. Zerbst, the majority, including Justice Roberts, had evidently deemed the same history irrelevant to the meaning of the Sixth Amendment today. In the constitutions and laws of the 48 states in 1942, Justice Roberts found a diversity of provisions on counsel, some requiring appointment in all cases, some in capital cases only, some merely permitting appointment in each court's discretion. This material demonstrates, he concluded, that, in the great majority of the states, it has been the considered judgment of the people, their representatives, and their courts, that appointment of counsel is not a fundamental right essential to a fair trial. On the contrary, the matter has generally been deemed one of legislative policy. In the light of this evidence, we are unable to say that the concept of due process incorporated in the 14th Amendment obligates the states, whatever may be their own views, to furnish counsel in every such case. Justice Roberts added that the logic of the uniform rule sought by Betts would require appointment of counsel in traffic courts and even in civil cases. The states should not be straitjacketed that way, he said. Want of counsel in a particular case may result in a conviction lacking in fundamental fairness, but that would have to be found from the circumstances. Turning to the facts of this case, Justice Roberts relied on the findings of Judge Bond. Altogether, the opinion mentioned Judge Bond by name 15 times, and Professor Freund has suggested that the esteem in which he was held may have influenced the result. The simple issue was the veracity of the testimony for the state and that for the defendant. As Judge Bond says, the accused was not helpless, but was a man 43 years old, of ordinary intelligence and ability to take care of his interests on the trial of that narrow issue. He had once before been in a criminal court, pleaded guilty to larceny, and served a sentence, and was not wholly unfamiliar with criminal procedure. Joining the opinion were Chief Justice Stone, as he had become at Hughes's retirement, and Justices Stanley F. Reed, Frankfurter, James F. Burns, and Jackson. The dissenting opinion was by Justice Black, and it foretold the philosophy he was to develop as a judge over the next two decades. He said for the first time that he thought the 14th Amendment had been intended to incorporate the 6th, but he did not press the point. Even the prevailing view of due process, he said, a view which gives the court such vast supervisory powers that I am not prepared to accept it without grave doubts, required provision of counsel for those too poor to retain their own. Briefly, Justice Black, whose opinion was joined by Justices Douglas and Murphy, explained why he thought the right to counsel was fundamental. He cited the language of some early state cases and of Justice Sutherland in Powell v. Alabama. He concluded that no man should be deprived of counsel merely because of his poverty. Any other practice seems to me to defeat the promise of our democratic society to provide equal justice under the law. Not long after Betts v. Brady was decided, it was severely criticized in a lengthy letter to the New York Times by Benjamin V. Cohen, the noted New Deal lawyer, and Irwin N. Griswold, then a professor, later dean of the Harvard Law School. The decision in Betts v. Brady comes at a singularly inopportune time, they wrote. Throughout the world, men are fighting to be free from the fear of political trials and concentration camps. From this struggle, men are hoping that a Bill of Rights will emerge, which will guarantee to all men certain fundamental rights. Most Americans, lawyers and laymen alike, before the decision in Betts v. Brady, would have thought that the right of the accused to counsel in a serious criminal case was unquestionably a part of our own Bill of Rights. That was just a hint of the criticism that began to reign on Betts v. Brady. Within a few years, some students of the court, perhaps indulging in wishful thinking, suggested that the doctrine was quietly being abandoned. The next two significant right-to-counsel cases, decided in 1945, resulted in 7-2 reversals of convictions for lack of counsel, Justices Roberts and Frankfurter dissenting. But those were capital cases, and before long it became evident that the court was drawing a line between trials involving a possible death sentence and all others. In capital cases, the court simply assumed that a fair trial could not be had without counsel. As it said when it finally put the distinction into words in 1961. When one pleads to a capital charge without benefit of counsel, we do not stop to determine whether prejudice resulted. In 1947, the court made it plain that in non-capital cases it was sticking to the flexible rule of Betts v. Brady. Explicitly relying on Betts, Justice Frankfurter said, "The abrupt innovation of a universal counsel requirement would furnish opportunities hitherto uncontemplated for opening wide the prison doors of the land," thus indicating the court's practical fears. For the next few years, every right-to-counsel case was weighed in terms of its special circumstances. The approach was best defined in a 1948 opinion by Justice Reed, Uvegish v. Pennsylvania, where the gravity of the crime and other factors, such as the age and education of the defendant, the conduct of the court or prosecuting officials, and the complicated nature of the offense charged, and the possible defenses thereto, render criminal proceedings without counsel so apt to result in injustice as to be fundamentally unfair, the accused must have legal assistance. Sometimes the differing uses of this formula produced such fine distinctions that virtually no one could understand them. On the same day in 1948, the court decided two right-to-counsel cases, Grieger v. Burke and Townsend v. Burke, affirming the conviction in the first and reversing in the second. Grieger claimed that he had been given a life sentence because the trial judge, misinterpreting state law, wrongly thought the statutes required that sentence. A 5-4 majority found no fundamental unfairness in the absence of counsel to correct such an error. Townsend said his judge had imposed sentence in the mistaken belief that he had been convicted on two earlier charges, which in fact resulted in acquittals. A 6-3 majority thought counsel was constitutionally required in those circumstances. The only conclusion one could state with certainty about the two cases was that Justices Jackson and Frankfurter, who made the difference by voting to affirm Grieger's conviction and reverse Townsend's, saw a distinction. But that the distinction rose to the level of defining due process of law was beyond most men's belief. The prevailing scholarly view of the succession of right-to-counsel decisions in the 1940s was expressed by Professor Allen. The cases decided by the court under the Betts formula are distinguished neither by the consistency of their results nor by the cogency of their argument. The rule, therefore, seems vulnerable to fundamental criticism, and so long as it persists, the law of the subject will remain in a state of unstable equilibrium. Sometimes when a constitutional decision comes under such severe scholarly attack, the court begins to retreat from it almost invisibly, paying it lip service but never really allowing it to stand in the way of desired results. Something like that seemed to be happening in the 1950s to Betts v. Brady. Opinions still frequently cited the case. But the last time the court actually affirmed a state criminal conviction in the face of a claimed denial of counsel was in 1950. Between that decision and the grant of review in Gideon's case, the court had held in favor of every state prisoner whose counsel claim it agreed to hear. There was an especially significant series of decisions beginning in 1960. In Hudson v. North Carolina that year, Justice Potter Stewart found counsel constitutionally required because Hudson's co-defendant had changed his plea to guilty midway in the trial, and that might have prejudiced Hudson before the jury. Justice Clark, joined by Justice Whitaker, dissented, remarking acidly that the court's opinion, without so much as mentioning Betts v. Brady, cut serious inroads into that holding. That was the last dissent in any right-to-counsel case before Gideon's. The next year, 1961, Justice Whitaker wrote for the court in McNeil v. Culver, reversing a conviction for assault because of the complex and intricate legal questions involved under the law of Florida. Justice Douglas, joined by Justice Brennan, wrote a separate concurring opinion of even greater interest. It called flatly for the overruling of Betts v. Brady, concluding, "Betts v. Brady requires the indigent, when convicted in a trial where he has no counsel, to show that there was fundamental unfairness. This is a heavy burden to carry, especially for an accused who has no lawyer and cannot afford to hire one. It is a burden placed on an accused solely by reason of his poverty. Its only sanction is Betts v. Brady, which is so at war with our concept of equal justice under law that it should be overruled. Are we to wait to overrule it until a case arises where the indigent is unable to make a convincing demonstration that the absence of counsel prejudiced him?" The language of that concurring opinion seemed to look to the Equal Protection Clause as much as the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. A few weeks later, in a lecture, Justice Brennan said that he was thinking in terms of equal protection. He cited Griffin v. Illinois, holding that a state could not distinguish between rich and poor in allowing appeals from criminal convictions. "The denial of counsel to an indigent accused," Justice Brennan said, "seems almost to be an a fortiori case of the violation of the guarantee of equal protection of the laws." In 1962, the court said unanimously that the legal issues at a proceeding under a multiple offender law, committing a man to an extended prison term simply because he had a certain number of felony convictions, were so complex as to require counsel. Many authorities would have regarded such proceedings as about as simple and straightforward as any could be in the criminal law. The Betts requirement of special circumstances to justify counsel had seemingly been stretched to the limit. Then, on April 30, 1962, the court decided Carnley v. Cochran, the fourth counsel case from Florida in the last 4 years. Once again, it held that in the particular circumstances the defendant should have had a lawyer. The Betts approach was still being followed. But in the Carnley case there was a difference. Two justices did not participate in the decision. Justice Whitaker had retired on April 1st, and on April 5th Justice Frankfurter had gone to the hospital. His illness was not then disclosed, but was in fact a stroke. Of the seven justices sitting, three, Chief Justice Warren and Justices Black and Douglas, joined in a concurring opinion urging that Betts v. Brady be overruled. But everyone knew there was another member of the court who felt that way, for Justice Brennan had said as much the year before and had certainly not changed his mind. Thus, the day of the Carnley decision, there was at least a 4-3 majority of the justices who favored a flat requirement of counsel in state criminal cases. Justice Brennan simply declined for the moment to invoke that broad ground, voting instead to find counsel required on the particular facts of this case. Why did he do so? Perhaps he felt it inappropriate to overrule a constitutional decision with less than a full bench present, when the result might be said to depend on the accident of vacant seats. Or perhaps he or others thought the grave step of overruling should be taken more deliberately, with counsel in some future case being explicitly directed to focus on the question of the Betts Doctrine's continuing validity. It was a little more than 2 months later when the Supreme Court granted Gideon's petition for review and directed counsel to brief and argue that question. Chapter 9. When Abe Fortas started to work on the Gideon case, he recognized that the current of legal history was moving with him. The whole thrust of recent decisions on criminal procedure was at war with the Betts philosophy of letting the states manage their trial procedures as they thought best. But these intimations of mortality for the 20-year-old doctrine did not mean that Fortas had no significant role to play as counsel assigned to argue for its formal burial. The court had chosen someone of more than ordinary experience and ability to represent Gideon, and the honor carried with it a special responsibility. If that most basic right, to be represented by counsel, was now to be extended to all those charged with serious crimes in any court, the justices would want all possible intellectual support for taking the step. And each justice would have his own viewpoint. Fortas saw his job as reaching each of the nine. "It's hard for me to describe it without sounding stuffy," he said later, discussing his feelings. "An advocate usually thinks about winning a case and doesn't give a damn whether he wins by 5-4 or some other vote. But in this case, a constitutional case of fundamental importance and with political overtones in terms of federal-state relations, it seemed to me the responsibility was not just to try to win the case, but to get as many justices as possible to go along with what I considered the right result. If you assume Betts v. Brady was going to be overruled, it was right for the institution of the Supreme Court, and for the law, to have as much unanimity as possible." Fortas thought his chances of winning 9 votes were slim. He started with an almost certain 4, the Chief Justice and Justices Black, Douglas, and Brennan. Justice Stewart, though he had not criticized Betts, seemed a hopeful prospect. In his 4 years on the Supreme Court, he had never voted to affirm a criminal conviction where the defendant claimed that he should have had counsel at his trial. Justice Clark was generally regarded as pro-government in criminal cases, and he had written the court's last dissent in a right-to-counsel case in 1960. On the other hand, he had written the opinion of the court in the 1961 search-and-seizure case, Mapp v. Ohio, reinterpreting the Constitution to outlaw illegal evidence in state criminal trials. The two strongest voices on the court for federalism and restraint in imposing new restrictions on state criminal procedures were those of Justice Frankfurter, who was ill but expected to return to the bench in the fall, and Justice Harlan. Fortas thought it unlikely that either would vote to overrule Betts v. Brady. Finally, there was the newest justice, former Deputy Attorney General Byron R. White, appointed by President Kennedy to replace Justice Whitaker. His views could hardly be known after 2 months on the bench, although a sharp dissent he had just written from a decision overthrowing a California narcotics law did seem to indicate a hard-boiled attitude in criminal cases. Since Fortas had been appointed to represent Gideon, his personal belief about the rightness or wrongness of Betts v. Brady could not affect his duty. But in fact, he strongly believed that representation by a lawyer was an absolute essential of fairness at any criminal trial. His own experience had so persuaded him, and he wished there were some way he could convey to the justices firsthand the atmosphere of the criminal courts. "What I'd like to have said," he remarked later, "was, 'Let's not talk. Let's go down and watch one of these fellows try to defend himself.'" But the business of persuading Supreme Court justices is naturally less direct. In his brief, Fortas would have to deal with all the themes traced over the last century in the court's interpretation of the words "due process of law" in the 14th Amendment. Fortas was not an expert on the 14th Amendment in general, or the right to counsel in particular, and so his first need was to educate himself. He began by calling in one of his partners, Abe Crash, a younger man who had worked with him on a number of important cases, and asking him to organize research for Gideon v. Cochran. Fortas said he wanted to know everything there was to know about the right to counsel. There immediately got underway the extraordinary process by which a large law firm digests a legal problem. Bright young men break it down into tiny components and write treatises on every conceivable issue. They probe, imagine, cover every exit. Then, from this jumble of material, a skilled lawyer creates a legal work of art, choosing a coherent form for his argument and ruthlessly eliminating all that is extraneous to that form. The end product is a particular understanding of the case, an understanding that informs the brief and the oral argument. A direct question, such as should Clarence Earl Gideon have had a lawyer at his trial, has become a much more sophisticated constitutional conception, not necessarily more remote from life, but richer in its reflection of history and philosophy and judicial attitudes. The process began at Arnold, Fortas, and Porter, with a memorandum drafted by an associate, James F. Fitzpatrick, on July 6, 1962, just 11 days after Fortas's appointment by the Supreme Court. It laid out the questions that Fitzpatrick thought the office ought to explore in preparing its brief in Gideon v. Cochran. The memorandum, much condensed, went as follows. Was the historical analysis in Betts, which buttressed the conclusion that appointment of counsel is not a fundamental right, correct? How has state law on appointment of counsel changed since 1942? Has there been a change in the concept of 14th Amendment absorption of the Bill of Rights since 1942? What has been the experience with the Betts test? What is the present status of right to counsel in European countries, in newly emerging countries, in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights? What has been the progress of the Griffin Equal Protection Doctrine, that barring a poor man's appeal because he cannot afford a trial transcript denies him the equal protection of the laws? In factual terms, can we get an estimate of how many felony defendants go to trial without counsel? If the 14th Amendment is now held to require counsel in all cases, what would be the additional demands on lawyers? These issues and research topics raise fundamental policy questions. 1. Should our brief attack the broad, existing rule that the 14th Amendment did not incorporate the Bill of Rights? Should we, alternatively, accept the standard that the 14th Amendment guarantees a fair trial and argue that a fair trial must include the right to counsel? 2. Should we make the twin argument that counsel is required by the Equal Protection Clause? 3. What should be the shape of a suggested rule? Does it apply to misdemeanors and traffic court offenses, to pretrial proceedings, to appeals? Arnold, Fortas, and Porter had taken on for the summer John Hart Eli, a Yale law student who would enter his final year in the fall. Crash decided to have him do the basic Gideon research, and for the next 2 months Eli worked exclusively on this case. A steady stream of typewritten memoranda went from him to Crash and Fortas, some in response to requests from them, others his own idea. The first of these was a list of 32 relevant law review articles on Betts v. Brady, most of them with titles indicating a critical approach. Another memorandum canvassed in detail the elaborate history of the Supreme Court's interpretation of the 14th Amendment. On July 25th, Eli submitted his first paper reflecting real thought about the right to counsel problem. It was a 25-page memorandum headed Application, Ambiguities, and Weaknesses of the Special Circumstances Rule. Eli had examined how the rule of Betts v. Brady, calling for counsel only where special circumstances exist, was actually applied in the state courts, especially the Florida courts. He concluded that the state courts used the same language as the Supreme Court of the United States and mentioned the same factors, but somehow came to different conclusions, almost always rejecting claims to counsel. The fact that the United States Supreme Court has reversed the Florida Supreme Court in 4 right-to-counsel cases since 1959, he wrote, suggests that the two courts have different ideas as to how the factors should be balanced. The real source of confusion, Eli suggested, was the number and variety of factors that the Supreme Court had said were relevant to deciding whether counsel was essential in a particular case. He listed more than 20 such factors that had been mentioned in majority and dissenting Supreme Court opinions, among them these: the complexity of the criminal statute, the defendant's age and education and mental ability and color, inadequacy of the judge's guidance at trial, misbehavior by the prosecutor, and, on the other side, imposition of a lighter-than-maximum sentence, a helpful attitude on the part of the trial judge, the defendant's prior experience with the criminal law. It is difficult to imagine a case, Eli concluded, in which at least 5 relevant factors could not be compiled for either side. Nor had the court been consistent. In 1948, it had rejected a plea for counsel on the ground that the trial judge had misunderstood state law. A mere error of state law was not enough of a special circumstance, the majority said. But in 1961, reversing a conviction, the court had emphasized the trial judge's patent violation.